The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of 55KRC, The Talk Station, and Clear Channel Worldwide.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, Cincinnati's only gun talk show. Join us. We're going to explore the topic of firearms and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Now here's your host, John Johnston, on 55KRZ, The Talk Station.
Good evening and welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. I'm your host, John Johnston. As always, check us out at ballisticradio.com and facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me tonight and guest tonight is going to be Sean, whose last name I'm not going to mention because, unlike most of us, there are actually people out there that wouldn't mind doing something bad to him. Sean, how are you doing tonight?
Pretty good, John. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I appreciate you coming in. You got kind of hung up a little bit on your flight, but glad you made it here last minute style. So I'm going to hop right in. Sean, what can you tell us about your background and just sort of go over that for a minute if you don't mind?
Sure. I joined the military right out of high school back in the early 90s. Did 4 years in the Marines, decided that was enough. I checked the box and had a good time, and I enjoyed it, but it was time to move on to something else. So I spent a couple of years out in the Pacific Northwest doing local law enforcement. When I was bit by a bug that said, go back in the military and find something bigger and better to do, so I did that, and went through special operations training in the late 90s, and we all know what happened September 11th. So that was early on in my career in special operations, and I never looked back.
Cool. And that's something you're still doing currently?
Absolutely.
Cool. Now, what would you say specialties as far as any theater environment sort of, where would you say your talents lie?
I've spent most of my time in the Middle East. I've also done 3 deployments down into North Africa as well, which don't make the daily news, but still, there's a lot of work to be done down there.
Cool. So, I guess this is first and foremost a show about shooting. How'd you get into shooting?
Yeah, I grew up with some buddies. We'd run around in the South Hills and shoot our 22s and whatnot. But serious shooting, I didn't actually take on until I got into law enforcement. Obviously, the military, the Marines, put a lot of emphasis on marksmanship, but it just wasn't something that I found as a hobby until I got into law enforcement, and I was able to start hanging out with some guys that were shooting on a regular basis outside of work, and I found it really enjoyable and good stress relief.
Cool. Cool. So a lot of people talk about kind of theoreticals as far as fights go. This does this, and this equipment will help you do that. And there's a lot of hypothetical back and forth between guys that have never really, you know, shot at someone or been shot at in return. As someone that's done both and had both happen to him, what would you say number one is?
I'd have to go with, you know, the person involved is probably the number one deciding factor. After that, it's their mentality. How am I approaching this? How do I approach my training? How do I approach my attitude and everything I do when I drive, when I go to the mall, when I go to the restaurant? Am I making sound decisions that are setting me up for success? And then once something has transpired where there is no walking away or talking out of it, it's decided to be violent enough soon enough.
Okay. And that's actually something that I've been telling people for a little while now when they come in and talk to me at the shop I work at. Just to be clear too, and I think this is kind of interesting, avoidance, first thing you brought up, how important would you say that is?
In the United States, I practice avoidance pretty much every day. If I can avoid neighborhoods, areas, groups of people that I hang out with, if they are magnets for trouble,
mm-hmm.
I tend to stay away from them.
So that whole don't go stupid places with stupid people and do stupid things.
Exactly. I don't walk downtown of the gang infested areas and the crackhead houses with $50 bills hanging out of my pocket at 3 in the morning, and it's amazing how often I don't get jumped down there.
Huh. That's kind of funny.
It's crazy.
That would be interesting to see that happen, because looking at Sean, he's not a big scary guy, but he's a big scary guy, if that makes sense. So I guess So going back to that reacting violently enough, quickly enough, what's that mean to you?
There comes a time, I think, and it doesn't matter whether I'm working overseas or whatever else. I know there's a lot of misconceptions that these guys in the black helicopters get to just do whatever they want when they're overseas or downrange, and that's just flat out not true. We're held to a much higher standard even than I would put it on comparison with law enforcement. I'm accountable for every round I fire. I have to write legal documents to justify it. And that transition to violent enough soon enough is when you identify through your training and experience that the situation has devolved to the point where the only solution to a violent act is return violence. Mm-hmm. And making that decision right now when it happens versus waiting to see how things develop or wait, let me let it escalate it three or four more times and put me further and further behind my power curve. You know, somebody comes in and starts shooting, we don't have anything to talk about.
Right.
You know, I'll let, to get cliche, I'll let Samuel Colt do my talking.
So just that whole decision-making process as far as deciding when to be violent, would you say that's what training does for us, is allow us to recognize threats quicker and react to them quicker, or what do you think there?
I think some training does. I think the bulk of the training that I've participated in as far as civilian trainers that will teach anybody open enrollment courses, there's a lot of focus on the physical, the manipulation, malfunction clearance, the mechanical accuracy, fundamentals, which I think is good because now you don't have to think about that.
Right.
When adrenaline takes over and you have to react, those mechanics will take place regardless of what's going on in your conscious mind, and that allows your conscious mind to focus on making those decisions, interpreting your environment, figuring out what is really happening versus what do I perceive is happening.
Okay, so that's where a class like Craig Douglas's Managing Unknown Contacts or ECQC or something like that.
Absolutely. Classes like Craig's are nothing new. Craig's one of the first guys to really bring it to the forefront, especially in law enforcement and civilian training. But military has been adopting those types of force-on-force, and not against some crazy professional role player, but against somebody who's essentially your peer as a student. What is this person capable of? And it really drives home the point that just because somebody looks mean doesn't mean they are, and just because somebody looks like maybe they need to hit the gym more often doesn't mean they can't clean your clock.
Yeah.
On demand. So
it just kind of just swings back to attitude, I guess, a lot of it.
It does. And I think it really shows folks what the warrior mindset looks like and what you have to inculcate in your own mind as you develop your personal protection plan. How am I going to deal with this? And what is important for my training and what isn't?
You know,
having a 1-inch capable Wilson combat's great, but mm-hmm. if you can't make it run,
right,
there's no point in wasting your money.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit more. And it's funny you brought up gear. It's not everything, but it does matter sometimes. We're going to be talking with Sean about what he uses and why. You're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Wealthy and wise, the Steve Perrin Coordinated Financial Planning Studios. This is 55 KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. We're talking to Sean, who is an interesting dude that I can't really talk too much about his background, but spent some time in the military, is still in the military doing special things with special people. And that sounds kind of weird, but hey, whatever. So back to gear. You were talking about Wilson earlier, but do you think too much importance is placed on equipment, would you say, or does it? What's your thoughts on that? Is there a happy medium?
I think there comes a point in time where equipment does matter. There's two camps that I see arguing back and forth. Equipment doesn't matter, and then yeah, absolutely, equipment matters. And I think it's somewhere in the middle is probably really where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
There are guys out there that could maximize the potential of a Wilson combat pistol.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of them, so I. have lots of custom guns, and that's my hobby. I have them because it's my hobby, not right. because I think there's some sort of real-world application that I'm gaining from having it. What I see a lot is arguing caliber, arguing a particular brand of gun, arguing a particular type of gun, when in reality, if it works and you're comfortable with it and you can make it work and you can hit what you're aiming at, it's probably a good gun.
Yeah. So just shot placement, I guess, would be key with almost anything.
I've never found anything to be contrary to that.
Yeah. So obviously most of the people that are listening to us right now are never going to ride around in helicopters and, you know, fast rope out of them or anything like that. For the concealed carry individual, you know, Mr. or Miss, you know, John Q. Public, what do you suggest as far as, I guess we'll go with a home defense role and then kind of move on from there. What do you think?
You know, home defense, I think, is really everybody's situation is going to be a little bit different than somebody else's. My situation has me contemplating having to hold a baby in one arm. I'm not going to be very effective with a pump-action shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
I know I can shoot an AR platform rifle one-handed, but I'm not going to be as effective if I just handle it with a pistol.
Right.
You know, there are places and times where a shotgun is extremely effective, but I've yet to hear a validated story where racking of a 12-gauge shotgun ended the fight before it began. I've heard lots of anecdotal stories of that, but nobody's ever been able to produce real evidence that that's actually worked. When you talk to criminals, especially the hardened criminals, the type that are doing home invasion robberies, they don't care.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, I brought a gun too, so what do I care about your little shotgun?
Right.
I think all three platforms, shotgun, carbine, and pistol, have an application in home defense. And obviously for the concealed carry, it's really hard to get an AR-15, you know, tucked inside your waistband.
Well, you'd kind of look a little silly. And unfortunately, in Ohio, it's a concealed handgun license, so we're kind of limited as far as that goes. So I guess you could put an AR pistol under a coat. That'd be sort of silly too, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd be very effective with an AR pistol.
Mm. Well, everyone's ears would be bleeding, at least. That's something. Fireballs. So I guess takeaway there is just have a clear understanding of what your, for lack of a better term, mission profile is and select something that fits in with that. Or
yeah, I think, you know, examine layout of your home. Do I need to, am I going to have to fight past other rooms to get to bedrooms where I have children? Or do I have a dog who's going to be intervening? Do I have, you know, all kinds of other things? As well as, what do I really expect to do? What is my end state? Do I really think I need to go clear my house room to room? Or can I just hold up in one position, call the police, let them come do their thing while I'm just have all my family in one spot? My house is fortunate. We're all on the upper level,
mm-hmm.
And I can basically stand in my doorway and do nothing but hold on the doorway and wait.
Right.
You know, a carbine or a shotgun's perfect for that.
Right.
But I don't know what else could happen. I could end up having to move or do something. And so my go-to is a high-capacity 9mm pistol.
Cool. So we'll switch directions a little bit. So more of a military question, but you hear a lot of people talking about either switching calibers or switching platforms. There should be an intermediate caliber, 6.8, 300 blackout. I mean, what, you know, and obviously you can't get too in-depth, but what are your thoughts on that as far as platforms, calibers, and all that?
I'm a big fan of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, if we stifle innovation, we stifle development. Sooner or later, we're going to get outclassed. You see a lot of the guidance systems and the technology that we're using are coming from overseas. Someday, maybe those people aren't going to be our friends and decide that they're not going to sell us that stuff.
Right.
You know, when it comes to, you know, strictly hardware down at the where the, you know, the metal meets the meat level, the rifles, the pistols, I still think there's a lot of benefit to development. But with the 6.8 and the 300 blackout especially, I think you're always going to find a niche in the military that's exploring those options. You know, but some of the things that have to get factored in are cost, and is it cost effective to switch over an entire military to something when the benefit maybe only be 20 or 30% increase in capability, Generally speaking, from what I know of procurement, they're looking for something closer to 40-50% solution versus something in the 10s or 20%. 300 blackout, I'm a big fan of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a very limited application projectile. 6.8, I was also a big fan of that. But again, you start limiting capabilities and where you can actually use it. We can't go forward pretending like we're going to fight today's war or handle today's missions, because tomorrow they're going to be different. My dad fought in Vietnam. My battles have been much different than what he had,
right,
which were much different than my grandfather's in World War II. So we can't use today's skirmishes to determine tomorrow's technology.
And it always seems like that's the way it goes, though, is the interesting part. So is going to the platform side of things, and I know a lot of people have been talking about the FN SCAR, which my understanding of that is that it had it started as more of a military rifle that was tested to death, and then they just happened to start selling it to civilians. And I know that you're pretty familiar with those rifles. Thoughts, opinions, you know?
I think it's a good rifle. I think it's probably one of the most refined and most accurate, most reliable AK-47s I've ever seen. It operates on the same long stroke piston principles as the AK. You get, for those that are in the piston camp, you get your gas piston.
Right.
And whatever benefits you think that has, it comes with it. The inherent accuracy of the rifle, FN does a great job of building their barrels. We tested FNs against various other manufacturers and found that even with their service grade, right off the shelf guns, no gunsmithing, no special triggers, no nothing. They outshot most of the AR platforms that were out there. It's giving you that option. The 5.56 guns, again, we went talking about the 60% solution versus a 20% solution, didn't offer enough of a solution. So the DOD and SOCOM in particular chose not to to replace the 5.56 rifles that they had in the inventory. But the 7.62 rifle was a capability gap that SOCOM didn't have, not one they were happy with anyway. There were some old rebuild M14s and some deviations and variants from those. But with the SCAR 17, you brought a new capability, user modified to different configurations, and that inherent accuracy that comes with those high quality of construction of the rifles.
Right.
So I'm a pretty big fan of it.
Ah, I couldn't tell. You kind of said this at the beginning, but I'm curious to get your actual opinion. It's a lot of talk between direct impingement and piston operated rifles, especially in the AR platform. Is there an actual benefit, or is that more of an imaginary sort of thing in your experience?
I think there's a time and a place. If you're shooting a lot of full auto, if you're shooting a suppressed full auto SBR, I think you'll definitely feel the benefits of a piston and not getting all the carbon and residual blowback right directly into the operating system. But the reality is there's guys out there that continue to, do bad things to bad people with direct impingement guns, and they keep working.
Huh.
I don't know what the hang up is. I think for a lot of folks, it's a better mousetrap.
Yeah.
Mentality. I don't know if it's better, but both of them work fine. I've got both in my personal inventory, and I'm comfortable with both.
Yeah. So, because I know there's been, at least with the HK416, and then there's the Mark 18, which is a Daniel Defense 10.3-inch upper on a Colt lower, two different operating systems there, and both in use, aren't they, for the most part?
I've seen both, and I've seen the actual original Mark 18 was from another vendor still, and they held up fine. The Mark 18 Daniel Defense guns that I've run into have all run well on various lowers, not just Colt, but several of the other manufacturers, BCM, Noveski, Smith & Wesson. I've even seen some lowers there. And the 416 is definitely, it's a great gun, but it's made out of unobtainium.
Right.
Best for most people.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you can find them, they're cost prohibitive for, you know, John Q. Citizen. And it's hard for me to justify that kind of money for.
Yeah, I've seen exactly one MR556 in the last year and a half, and it was stupid expensive at a good price and was kind of heavy too, I've noticed. But we've got 50 seconds left, and we'll obviously delve into this a little bit more. So platform, not really something that needs to be changed. Caliber, not something that needs to be changed. Maybe better ammunition, better training.
I think training is definitely an issue. I think there's always better. That's also coming from I am a trainer now, and I think it can always be better regardless of what kind of product I'm putting out. Until we start seeing ray guns, rail guns that are fit on something other than a giant Navy ship.
Right.
You know, caseless ammunition. Until we start seeing a huge increase in technology, I think we're about there with smokeless powder and metal projectiles.
Hmm. So, well, that's interesting to hear. We're going to get into a couple more things when we come back. Specifically, obviously, there was a recent attack in Boston. So everyone's perception of what can and can't happen here has changed a little bit. We're going to talk with Sean a little bit more about what we can do to be better prepared in the case of a mass casualty event. You're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Ryan Thomas, Monday in the Morning Show. Of course, my dad's going to be on 7:05, mad about something. Tune in to the Spleen Man, 55 KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. For folks just tuning in, you can call us at 749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255 if you're not in the area. Don't have anyone on the line currently, so we might actually get to your call. Just keep in mind, Sean might make fun of you if you ask him a really good question, so you never know. So we're talking to Sean, who is Special Forces type. I mean, it's funny because usually I can really get into people's backgrounds a little bit and explain, you know, what they do and why they do it. And this has been a challenge for me just because one of the things that I had to agree to before you'd come on the show was, well, hey, don't say this and don't say that and don't say that. So it's kind of been interesting. But anyway, going back to what we were sort of getting into, terrorist attacks don't seem to happen too often here, especially compared to the rest of the world. Thank you, Sean. But so they do happen. What do you think people can do to be better prepared for stuff like that?
Well, I think there's a couple of phases of preparedness when you're talking about something of that magnitude and the potential for just massive devastation like we saw in Boston. You know, we especially concealed carry holders, we run around and we make sure that before we go out, we've got our flashlight, we've got our pistol, we've got our magazines. But how many of us actually stop and say, hey, do I have ability to stop massive hemorrhage? Do I have the ability to respond if there was something of that nature? It's as simple as a tourniquet and some quick clot gauze, two items you can throw in a pocket, and definitely has the ability to save a life. Other phases, though, are you know, target indicators. I see a backpack sitting on the side of the road. That's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time to call in law enforcement. There's a reason that for the last 25 years in airports, they tell you if you leave a bag unattended, expect the bomb squad to come in and blow it up. you know, and I think it's prudent at this point in time, we start looking at that beyond our nation's airports and start looking at things. Any type of event where there's a large gathering of people is a potential target area. You know, we saw it at the Olympics in 96. We've seen it at the federal building in Oklahoma City. Now we're seeing it at the Boston Marathon. I get it. There's a lot of bags and athletes and things running around, but those are all in you know, pre-coordinated areas. They're staged specifically. Something doesn't look right. That's not the time to be, you know, worry about being Chicken Little and the sky is falling. Go tell somebody.
Right.
You know, and we've got the medical thing. If you can be at least a little bit prepared, a couple of pieces of trauma kit that you can carry with you. And even if you don't know how to use it at a mass casualty incident, I guarantee somebody there
does,
and they can put it to use. You know, having it's half the battle.
Right. It's kind of hard to fabricate a tourniquet out of nothing, yeah, I suppose. Mean,
if you got a belt or, you know, a long sleeve shirt, that's great. It's what, 68 degrees here today. I'm not wearing a long sleeve shirt.
Yeah.
There are times when I'm wearing shorts and I'm not wearing a belt.
Mm.
See,
if I do that, my pants fall down, so I have to keep the belt on. I guess I've always got a tourniquet with me.
Yeah, I don't. Right now, I'm not wearing shoes with laces, so I can't turn shoelaces in. I actually almost never wear shoes with laces. So,
I've met guys like that before, and I can't do that either. Whatever. Shoes are weird. I don't really like them that much. That has nothing to do with shooting, though, or guns or concealed carry, so I guess I should.
Well, I think if you go with the argument of always look cool while you're doing whatever, shooting or carrying guns or whatever, I think, you know, definitely making sure that you have a high-quality pair of flip-flops is part of the equation.
Ah, ideal. I knew you'd get the flip-flops thrown in at some point.
Absolutely.
I was warned by various people that know you. So going back on topic just a little bit, I guess having the stuff, like you said, there's a little more to it than having the gun and knowing how to use the gun. And it sort of goes back to mindset as far as just being prepared for things in general. First aid class, good idea for most folks?
I think absolutely. I think anybody in the modern world, there's really no excuse for not having at least the rudimentary skills in first aid. And beyond, you know, mama kissing the cut and putting a Band-Aid on it, there's more to it than that. But it comes in handy, and I don't know how many times I've been places where I remember as a kid walking into a restaurant and a lady come running out. Does anybody know CPR? Man's having a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that just drives the point home. It doesn't necessarily have to be a doomsday scenario where having some advanced first aid training is going to help you out, whether it's CPR, child, infant CPR, the ability to stop a massive bleeding wound. Stabilize a spinal column until advanced care can get there. There's lots and lots of places out there. The Red Cross teaches some first responder type classes, and then there's a lot of people, a lot of retired military, retired law enforcement, paramedic types that offer tactical medicine training to civilians, specifically dealing with gunshot wounds and amputations and the type of massive trauma you see from terrorist attacks and mass shootings and things of that nature.
Yeah, and it's an unfortunate side effect of the last 10 years or so that a lot of our doctors and corpsmen and you know, everyone else coming back from the wars has a lot of firsthand experience with gunshot wounds and amputations and things of that nature. So it's like you said, there's a lot of good training out there.
It's definitely unfortunate, but I think at the same time, it is fortunate. The things unfortunate, the way we had to learn, but fortunate the fact that medicine, especially when it deals with gunshot wounds, amputations, has blossomed far beyond where we were 10 years ago.
Right. Another couple minutes before the commercial break. I guess everyone seemed extremely surprised by what had happened, and I know it was sort of shocking, which I guess is a point, but do you think this is something that we just kind of have to get used to, that every so often there's going to be something like this that occurs, or what's your thoughts on that? I mean, are we turning into the rest of the world?
I think it's unfortunate that someone would make a comparison, I've seen those comparisons made since the attacks, that, oh, we're becoming just like fill-in-the-blank country.
Yeah.
I would offer to go ahead and, you know, give that person a one-way ticket to said country and then decide whether we're turning into those countries or not. We're not. There's a certain degree of crazy that we can't control. There's the Tim McVeighs, the guys that perpetrated the bombings in Boston. There are definitely target indicators, but mostly only going to be people that see them on a daily basis, that are having daily interaction, that are going to see the changes in these people before they perpetrate some, you know, terrible attack like they did. But I don't think that because there's a school shooting or because there's a mass shooting at a hospital or an abortion clinic or a building gets bombed or some people get blown up by some IEDs at a race, that somehow translates into becoming a country similar to the violent countries we see in the rest of the world, where daily bombings. I know Iraq's not in the news anymore, but if you dig through about the 17th, 18th page, you'll see the two paragraph article where 27 people were killed in a church bombing. We're not there, thank goodness. And you know, I think the law enforcement community, local, state, federal law enforcement, does a great job of keeping it from that. Unfortunately, there's you can't fix crazy, and there's always going to be a crazy person out there.
All right, we're going to talk with you a little bit more. You guys can actually ask Sean your questions after the break. You can call us at 749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. No one on the line right now. We did get a couple questions called in, though. You're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
This is your exclusive home for Glenn Beck.
Oh, man.
Tomorrow at 9:06 on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Oh, welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station. Brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. I really wish we had a webcam or set up in the studio, because I've actually never seen a pair of headphones try and strangle anyone before, Sean. That was entertaining. Thank you. So we've got a couple calls. The first one, the guy didn't stay on the line, but asked whether or not a CZ-75B was good for a first-time gun. I know the CZ platform is not necessarily thought of as robust, and double action, single action triggers, some people are down on those. I'm actually a big fan of them personally. What are your thoughts, Sean?
That's a question I get from a lot of friends and family that know that's my hobby, and as well as the exposure I get professionally to the various platforms out there. You know, I think as long as it works, and you know, you can hit the broadside of a barn, I think there's nothing wrong with a CZ as a first gun. I think there's nothing wrong with a lot of guns as a first gun, because what we tend to find as we grow and mature as shooters, that first gun, maybe it wasn't the best choice, but I can't tell a one person what is absolutely best for him. It's the double action, single action trigger. I know a lot of professional instructors who frown upon it. And I think there's some merit to a consistency in trigger pull. I shoot a double action, single action, and I don't have any issues. The issues that I've had presented to me, the problems with that type of action, I've never found. I started shooting a Glock, and I transitioned to a double action, single action pistol, and still those problems never surfaced, not from as a beginning shooter all the way up to present day. So you can definitely train around it. It might, you know, if somebody's only going to shoot 10 rounds a year, well, maybe the double action, single action isn't the right solution. But I think the best way to answer the question is, if it's a gun from a major manufacturer and they have several thousands of these guns in production and they've been adopted by at least one major agency somewhere in the world, it's probably a good bet for a first gun.
Okay, cool. Let's see. We've got another caller, Bill, who is on a cell phone, who has a question, and that is the most I know about what his question is. So this will either be really good or really interesting. We'll see. Bill, are you there?
Hopefully it's a good question. First of all, to plug the double action, single action, I have a SIG 245 that I love to death. It's safe, I think. It's a great platform, so I just wanted to give a plug for that.
Yeah,
so my question is around AR-15. Single point swing, double point, triple point. My gosh, I'm confused, and I'm kind of new to that platform and just using it for home defense and general shooting, and it's hard to make a choice. There's a billion different choices out there, and didn't know if you had some thoughts or ideas about that.
Sean?
I actually have several thoughts on it, and that's a great question, and one that I don't get enough of, especially from even my younger guys that I work with. I think for most intents and purposes, a quality two-point sling will solve the majority of the issues for just about anything, any situation. Now, by a two-point sling, I don't mean the carry strap that the military uses for parade slings and those nature. It needs to be adjustable. It needs to work from the side mounts, allowing it to hang comfortably. The single point slings are neat. They are definitely sexy. I've seen them with the bungee cord and everything else, but they're a very limited application, and the time comes that you need to let go of your rifle to handle something else, whether it's a dog or a child or start administering first aid. The single point slings have the rifles flopping around and hitting you in all kinds of places you really don't want buttstocks and pistol grips and magazines hitting you. The 3-point slings, my big issue with those is they've really devolved to the point where most of the instructions to mount them to whatever particular platform, whether it's a 20-inch rifle or a 10.5-inch SBR AR, the instructions are longer than the sling themselves. And if I have if I have to go into that level of reading to figure out how to install the sling, that's probably a bad purchase. I think there's a lot of good quality 2-point slings out there, and they come with instructions that are usually a paragraph long, but most folks can actually pull the sling out of the box, look at it, and figure it out. And I think that's a high-quality sling at that point.
Well, that is truly the advice I was looking for. I was leaning towards a 2-point. There's a padded version that I've read some really good reviews online about, and I've kind of been leaning toward that. So I appreciate your input.
Yeah, certainly.
Hey, thanks for calling in. You have a good right. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Thank you, too.
Thanks. So, hey, not too bad. And just to go back to 2-point slings real quick, I don't know what you prefer. I'm kind of a fan of the Blue Force gear, the V-Cast, I think it is, or whatever. It's got that adjustable slider. Anyway, you can find those online. We'll go back to mindset a little bit, just since we don't have anyone on the line right now. If you would like to call in, you can. We might have time to take your call. Once again, 749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. We're talking to Sean. Going back to the mindset thing, there are all sorts of examples of people kind of fighting through things that should have killed them and didn't, just because they decided they weren't going to die. I'm thinking of one particular incident where someone was shot quite a bit and then managed to kill who shot him. Can you tell us the approved version of that story, or just kind of get in that a little?
Sure. You know, and that's in, I think a lot of people, I mean, you get these anecdotal stories, and I think a lot of people dismiss them just as that. Showing these examples of the mother lifting the car off the baby and those things. But these things are happening every day, and it's not popular with mainstream media, so we don't hear it all the time. But a buddy of mine was serving overseas several years ago during a direct action target assault to capture a high-level target. Was shot 17 times from across the room by AK-47s and captured M-16s. Several of the bullets had made it through his body armor, and several more had caused peripheral hits and massive bleeding and trauma and whatnot. And as you can imagine, you know, he did go down.
Jeez.
As the four enemy the four bad guys were changing magazines, he'd made a conscious decision that he was not going to end it like that. He pulled out his sidearm and returned fire, killing all four of them, and then got up and walked out of the house to get medical aid. Several years of surgeries and rehab later, he's back on his feet. He's worse for the wear, but you don't survive. Doctors said at least three or four of those gunshots that he took were non-survivable wounds by themselves. But he maintained his mental capacity, stayed in the fight mentally, even after the fight was over, and said, "I'm not dying here, not today, not like this."
Okay, and that just goes to show that that's most of anything, almost. It's just the guy or gal and deciding that you're not going to lose. So we have one more question. We've got about 3 minutes left. Richard has a question about school shooting prevention, which, going back to the crazy people do crazy things, I don't know how much prevention there is, but curious to hear your thoughts. Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am. I was reading about a survey that was done for the last 15 years of all the children that were shooting other children in the schools, and I didn't know this till recently, that the government did autopsies on every one of these kids, and these kids were on mind-changing drugs that were prescriptions by doctors. And my question is, you know, what can we do about, you know, this is an ongoing problem with giving drugs that are so out of control that they make kids do crap like this, you know?
Well, I think you're, and I have actually a psychology background. That's what I went to school for, so I'll actually try and hit this one. The thing to keep in mind is that you're sort of putting the cart before the horse there. Just because they were on antidepressants or something of that nature, that is something that they did to try and treat an overlying symptom of something else that was wrong, either an antisocial personality or depression or combination of the two, if that makes sense. So,
okay, but if the but a lot of the cases that the drugs were, well, the reason they were given from this study was not what the drugs were actually to do. You know, they were for something else other than what the problem that the kid had, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, you actually see that a lot of times with different medications. I mean, valproic acid is something that's used to treat, I want to say, seizures, and I'm going to get yelled at by a friend of mine after the show because I'm getting this wrong, but also happens to be good antipsychotic as far as it takes the wind out of your sails and your impulse control gets a little bit better. So, I mean, you see that in the medical field a lot of times. I mean, for instance, and this is going to get a laugh, but Viagra was not originally designed to treat erectile dysfunction. It was designed to treat something different. It just happened to have an application for that. If that makes sense. I mean, I don't see any sort of big conspiracy there.
Well, I wasn't saying it was a conspiracy. I'm just saying it's a from what the I only have time to give you obviously the whole report, but
yeah.
I'm just saying that it, from what they're in the report, that it was misuse of pharmaceuticals that these kids were on. So
We'll probably never know. I mean, it's kind of hard to say why people do crazy things. But I appreciate you calling in, Richard. I hope you enjoy
okay.
the rest of your Sunday.
Bye now.
Bye. So, well, sorry, that one wasn't quite in your venue. But, I mean, any thoughts there?
No, I mean, like you said, there's, you know, that is not my area of expertise, and I'm a firm believer in staying in my lane. I think when we actually looking at school shootings, I was in high school when the first one went nationwide, more years ago than I care to admit now. But you know, we've created target-rich environments. Why do they continue to go to school? Why would a crazy person bent on massive destruction go to a children's camp on an island or to a elementary school? Because there's no resistance. I don't see crazy people trying to break into my house. I don't know why. Maybe because I sit out in the garage and reload, and maybe because all the neighbors know what I do for a living, but you know, if we really want to protect our children, we need to create environments that actually protect the children, not set them up as lambs to the slaughter.
Yeah, kind of just we've actually there's been a big fight in Ohio recently about getting armed people in schools and all that. But we're actually running out of time here. It went real quick. I appreciate you coming in, Sean. Thanks for stopping by and actually making it in studio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So next week, we're actually going to be talking to Tom Givens of Range Master in Memphis about more than 60 of his concealed carry students have gone on to win gunfights with the training he provided. Anyway, we're going to see you next Sunday at 7 p.m. right here on 55KRC, the talk station. Make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Y'all be safe.